The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. On today's episode, I'll be speaking to Robert L. Fitzpatrick, author of False Prophets. Robert is an expert in multi-level marketing and pyramid sales fraud. He's been widely interviewed in quoted places like 60 Minutes, Mother Jones, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. He's served as expert witness for the U.S. Department of Justice Attorneys General in four states, and he's provided consulting and expert services in more than 20 court cases against pyramid schemes. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Robert.
Happy to be here.
So you've been researching multi-level marketing for years now. So why this topic specifically?
I didn't really choose it. It chose me. Life did it to me. It began from a very powerful, for me, quite profound personal experience about 25 years ago, in which I became involved through friends, as is typical, in what was revealed to be a classic pyramid scheme. This was not a multi-level marketing company, but was a type of scheme that has come to be called gifting schemes. And it was a scheme in which you invested money and then you could, by enrolling other people in it, you could gain as much as an 800% return. And not only could you get an 800% return, but you could re-enroll and continue the process seemingly forever. And so I was involved in that briefly because the police actually eventually broke it up and it collapsed. And upon collapse, it was revealed to me and to many others as for what it was, an endless chain, a pyramid scheme, an impossible proposition. Only the people who joined at the beginning would possibly be right. able to get their money. And that experience fascinated me. I was astounded that I and others like me who were at the time educated could fall into such a simple-minded scam. And I just had to understand it. I also had experienced emotionally this strange euphoria that accompanies these schemes that make this promise of endless money flowing to you, a kind of ecstasy in which you suddenly feel that the entire burden of financial security and insecurity that we carry around goes away. And that was something I just had to understand. Where did this come from? Who created this? And it led to my writing about it, which then was folded into a study of multi-level marketing, because shortly after that scheme collapsed, multi-level marketing entered the South Florida, where I was living at the time, place. And it seemed to be everywhere, and everybody was questioning and trying to recruit me. But by now, I had sort of understood the math and the trick, and it is just a math trick. And so I incorporated multi-level marketing, and that led to the writing of a book. And from the book came opportunities and requests for consulting, for testimony, for media appearances, and each one of those experiences added to my knowledge, and my interest has never waned.
Maybe let's give people some background. What exactly is a multi-level marketing program?
Well, multi-level marketing today is a business. It's a form of business, and it's quite new, actually. It's traced to the 60s that it began, but it was very small, obscure, relatively unknown at that time. But some of these companies were developing in that time. And they were very quickly identified as illegal because they were inducing people to make purchases, to invest in a sales opportunity, and the inducement was based on a promise of income. And the income promise depended upon your enrolling other salespeople, and then you would earn a percentage on their purchases and sales, and when they enrolled others, you would earn on those, and it would extend forever. So there was a potential built into the system where anyone without having to be promoted or selected by anybody, if they recruited enough people, who recruited enough people, could somehow harness the power of exponential expansion. It would expand your income massively. So it became a very popular way of inducing people to become salespeople for the product, and it became a new business model. But as I say, it was identified as an inherently deceptive, because you can't keep expanding forever. And so it was acknowledged and recognized by authorities as a pyramid scheme, as a Ponzi scheme, as an endless chain, a fraud. And laws were written to stop it. In 1975, the Federal Trade Commission prosecuted the largest of these new companies, and it was called Amway. And a four-year court case ensued, and at the end, a judge ruled that Amway was not a pyramid scheme, as long as the commissions that it was paying to the salespeople, and those commissions could be tied to this endless chain. But ultimately, these commissions had to be tied to end-user purchases, retail purchases. In other words, you couldn't just get another person to join, buy inventory, and you get paid. Then that person recruits another salesperson who buys inventory, and you get paid on both of them. They had to produce retail sales equal to what they had purchased. Then it would not be simply a Ponzi or a pyramid scheme. It would be retail-based. It would be sales-based.
Right.
So a kind of thin dividing line was established legally. It would have required great oversight for the government to have maintained that thin line, and that oversight never occurred, because immediately after that, a new administration came into Washington, the Ronald Reagan administration, that was quite opposed to regulations. And the FTC, the entire leadership of the FTC turned over, and nobody really went and monitored MLM schemes to see if they were, in fact, truly retail-based businesses. And so they developed, in many cases, as mere pyramid recruiting schemes with very little actual selling to real customers occurring.
Let's get the big question out of the way, because I know that people want to know this. Is it possible to make money with an MLM?
Well, we've looked at about 300 of them, and we've examined the pay plans. What we know is that of the 300 we examined, the income that is promised to you comes from one of two sources, or both. One is the so-called overrides or bonuses or commissions that flow to you from the purchases of the people you recruited. The other would be from your own sales, you know, so you could buy the product and resell it. We looked at over 300 of them, and we saw a 99% loss rate among them. So we concluded that the vast majority of these schemes are money traps. Could you potentially earn any money if you sought to sell the product yourself? On a retail basis, it would be extremely difficult, but theoretically possible. If you turn back to the bonuses and override commission, those are structured in such a way that the vast majority of those dollars only go to the people at the very top. And we've looked at several of these schemes, such as Herbalife, for example, a very big one. And over 80% of all the commissions that they say they offer as bonus and overrides, they call them royalties, actually go to the top 1%. So there's very little money in that pool for the average person. And then the other revenue source, which would be your own personal retail selling, we didn't see that was truly feasible on a cost basis for most people. So could it be done? Theoretically, yes, it could. In practical terms, we just didn't see it.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest today is Robert L. Fitzpatrick, expert in multi-level marketing and pyramid sales fraud. He's also the author of False Prophets. And we have an email question. It's from Andre.
Whatever happened to caveat emptor? Shouldn't people be responsible for researching any business that they're going to get involved in?
I don't think caveat emptor was ever meant to mean that fraud was fine, deception was fine, and you just are on your own, you better be prepared to figure it out. Caveat emptor is about conventional, fair marketplace transactions where you're on your own, you make your decisions. But it was never intended to be a substitute or an endorsement of some kind of a right to deceive. And if you get caught, too bad for you. It never meant that.
So the first multi-level marketing organization that I heard about was Amway, and you mentioned it. So what's the backstory there?
I think I began a little bit speaking about how Amway was prosecuted in the 1970s by the United States government. And the Federal Trade Commission made the case that this was a blatant pyramid scheme, an endless chain. Amway argued itself out of that case over a four-year period and convinced the judge that as long as it was retail-based, that even though it offered a endless chain, it would never use the endless chain as an enticement for making money. The money was still tied to retail selling. Amway evolved over time, in my view, to a point where the retail sales actually fell away as a prime driver of the business, if they were ever there at any level. No, I really, that goes beyond my direct experience. If you take it back into the 60s and 70s, perhaps it had a greater element of retail selling. But by the 80s and 90s, it had very little. And in fact, Amway itself published a document as a result of this prosecution that acknowledged that less than 25% of its products ever got sold. So it has been sued repeatedly. Amway just was sued and has just settled a class action lawsuit in which the plaintiffs, who were distributors, they charged that Amway was not a retail business at all, that very few people actually sold Amway products to anyone other than another salesperson. And these other salespeople bought the product as part of the pay plan, and that the name of the game was simply buy in, make your purchases, buy them every month so you meet your quota, and then go out and hit the streets and your friends, your neighbors, your family, and try to get them to do the same thing you've done. And that in fact was nothing but an endless chain. It doomed the last ones in. And in fact, that's what happened, that 60, 70% of the people realized they couldn't extend the chain themselves at a sufficient number to do this. They would quit, lose their investments, and they were simply churned through and another group was recruited. Now, Amway is settling that lawsuit and they will be paying out tens of millions of dollars, but they'll be able to continue their business as they were before. Amway was prosecuted by the government of England because the English government, this was only 4 years ago, did some research and realized that over a 30-year period, of all the people in the UK that had ever invested as salespeople, less than 1% had ever made a net profit. The two executives, top executives of Amway, were interviewed recently by the Wall Street Journal in a video interview, and the Wall Street Journal reporter asked them plainly, "How much of your product is retail?" Of course, they offered no verification of this, but they said half of the products are retail. Well, even if that were true, although other lawsuits have said that as little as 10%, less than 10% is actually retailed. Again, Amway offers no verification and does not track it, so it has really no way to know. But if only half were retailed, it would still be an insufficient amount. It would mean that half of the money is coming only from the salespeople themselves.
Why don't we hear about this? Because Amway appears to people to be a fairly credible organization at this point, doesn't it?
In my view, it has purchased credibility. There is always around Amway a hint of wrongdoing. There's always a hint of scam. If you look up on Amway's, look on the website and put Amway and fraud, Amway and pyramid scheme, you'll see hundreds of thousands of hits on that, of pages. It's everywhere. But officially, it's on the board of directors of the United States Chamber of Commerce,
exactly.
Better Business Bureau. The son of one of the founders ran for governor of Michigan recently. It was listed as the second, only to Enron, as the top contributors to the Republican Party in the 2000 election. So it has actually, in many ways, purchased legitimacy, but it has never been able to shake the accusations that it is something pretty horrible, really, that these class action suits are charging a pyramid scheme, that it is not even a direct selling company at all, that a Wall Street Journal reporter would have to ask a direct selling company how much of your products are sold to the public, because the question is equivalent to asking, are you a fraud or not?
You're tuned in to Skeptically Speaking. And we'll be right back with Robert L. Fitzpatrick, founder of Pyramid Scheme Alert, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today's episode is all about multi-level marketing, pyramid schemes, and the fuzzy line between the two. I'm joined by Robert L. Fitzpatrick, author of False Prophets. He's an expert in multi-level marketing and pyramid sales fraud. Now, there's a new-ish one, which is actually the inspiration for today's episode. My son and his friends were actually approached by Fortune High Tech Marketing, and I understand you're familiar with the company.
Yes, I'm very familiar with it. It made a big splash where I live, which is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Such a big splash that the wife of the now former CEO of Bank of America, Ken Lewis, became associated as a recruiter and was quoted in the media defending the company. But it was also at this same time prosecuted by the insurance commissioner, which is sort of equivalent in terms of regulation to the attorney general of the state of Montana. And so it was being prosecuted for fraud in Montana, while the wife of the former CEO of the Bank of America here in Charlotte was endorsing it.
And so it's basically the same kind of setup as Amway.
Yes, it's similar to Amway, although Amway has proprietary products that they actually make. Fortune High Tech Marketing was more of an association with other people's products. As it turned out, some of these companies disavowed any connection to it, and said that these relationships that were supposed to be partnerships, they were presented as partnerships, were in fact merely some kind of a market affiliate. You know, you can basically go and sell for anybody through several layers removed. It doesn't mean you're a partner with Barnes & Noble if you're able to, you know, promote them on your website or link to their website or something. But that's kind of what the company was implying, that this was a marketing partnership with some very big brand name companies, and that some of those proved not to be true. Also, the company charges a fairly significant amount of money to join. And whereas, you know, in Amway and others, there's usually a smaller amount. So the accusation was that most of these bonuses and payments that were being promised were really coming from the payments that the new salespeople were making themselves in order to join the scheme.
You mentioned search terms earlier and looking up information on the internet. And when I was researching FHTM, it was interesting because it seems like they had conquered search terms.
I can tell you from my own research experience, which would be over a period of time. And there was a period where if you bumped up against a scheme like this, and you said, I'm going to look it up on the internet, and you said, just as a precaution, I'm going to put in here, you know, Fortunatech marketing and scam. And there was a time where, oh my God, here, looky here, here's a testimonial from somebody that's on a website, or here's a chat room somewhere where there's a thread where you could see a discussion of this. Here's actually a record of a prosecution or a lawsuit, and you learn something. It's virtually impossible now. All of these schemes now jam the internet, and they produce a deluge the internet with fake testimonials and false leads. So you will see a page that will say, is Fortune High Tech Marketing really just another scam? Ah, turns out to be somebody that's recruiting for Fortune High Tech Marketing.
That is exactly it. Yeah. It's insane.
So these things have now created, they have flooded the internet with false testimonials, false leads, false negatives, and so on, making it really difficult to research them in any way. Caveat emptor would be really hard to do here now because, you know, you're under some obligation from friendship. There's affinity going on. There's nothing but positive stuff. And there's no way to actually dig into this thing to find out what it really is about. So, you know, yeah, you could be a good skeptic and you could say, I'm just not convinced. I'm going to hold back. But the way they present it to you, the idea is go ahead and join up and then figure it out. And often people do exactly that. That way they have fulfilled their obligation to the friend. Maybe the initial sign up wasn't going to bankrupt them, 300, 400, maybe something like that. Maybe it's worthwhile, who knows, but I'll get into it and figure it out. So by the time you do figure it out, if you decide, well, they made their money.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. My guest today is Robert L. Fitzpatrick, expert in multi-level marketing and pyramid sales fraud. We have some email questions. Now, this one is from the chat from Grave Spinner.
Are the laws regulating MLMs in Canada any more restrictive than those in the U.S.?
The laws in Canada are more restrictive. Canada has a wonderful fraud law that actually spells out an endless chain quite clearly. Canada also has a competition bureau, which is sort of equivalent to the United States Federal Trade Commission. But I'd have to say, and I was on a CBC Marketplace show a few years ago that did an inquiry into a particular scheme, multi-level marketing that was sweeping all over Canada, east to west, called Business in Motion.
Right.
Business in Motion. They had billboards up in some places to join Business in Motion. And the CBC Marketplace show felt this scheme was quite suspect, and they invited me up for a few days. I spent in Toronto. And this question, of course, came up all the time. How could this scheme be operating if it is as fraudulent as I was saying it was, and as the numbers showed that it was, because I demonstrated the implausibility of the marketing plan, the endless exponential expansion and so on. And we had to ask the question, what's going on in Canada? What's going on with the Competition Bureau? And we had to conclude that, one, the Competition Bureau literally adopted rules that, in a way, gave a pass to multi-level marketing. In other words, endless chains are under Canadian law, clearly illegal. But under the law of the Competition Bureau, if it's called a multi-level marketing company, it gets to operate legally, and it somehow supersedes the plain fraud law.
That makes no sense.
It doesn't. But in effect, what Canada did, and this is reflected in exactly what the U.S. did, it has protected these schemes. Even though they acknowledge that an endless chain is inherently fraudulent, they let these schemes go. About the only thing that the Competition Bureau is doing in Canada is requiring these companies to publish average income disclosures, which are quite useless in reality. Because, well, you're not average, are you?
Oh.
So what if the average is $20 a month or $100 a month and it costs $400 to join, plus monthly purchases of inventory, and the average published is some ridiculously small number? What has that got to do with you? You're not average, so don't worry about that. So it has very little effect on people. CBC Marketplace had to wonder itself what was wrong. And again, the specter of political influence kept coming up. Companies that have billions in sales, high-level positions with the Chamber of Commerce, sitting at the right hand of U.S. presidency, Canada is not going to go and bring that company down, in my view. There's a political intimidation factor here. And I think it extends across the United States, and we've documented this quite extensively to look at the levels of influence that these companies have had politically, their inside connections. Just to give you an example, in the late 1990s, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission was, in fact, beginning to aggressively prosecute these schemes. And they prosecuted more in 4 years than they had in the previous 17 years. Not only that, they had secured federal court decisions that affirmed, again, that if the company does not have significant retail sales behind it, it is illegal. And this looked like these court rulings were going to be the demise of this industry, because finally that 1979 ruling that tied bonus commissions to retail sales by requirement was going to be monitored and enforced. This industry poured money into the political campaigns to get a new administration in 2000. And when George Bush came into power in 2000, one of his first appointments was a new chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, a man named Timothy Muris, who came to the job from a law firm that represented Amway. And he then became the chairman, and prosecutions essentially stopped here. He made as his chairman of the Bureau of Consumer Protection in the FTC a man who had only recently testified against the FTC on behalf of a multi-level marketing company that the FTC was prosecuting. Now that person is over on the other side working for the FTC after just testifying against the FTC on behalf of one of these schemes, a scheme that, by the way, called Equinox, that was in fact shut down. And it was shut down, and they FTC had estimated it had cost consumers $300 million. And this guy had testified on behalf of them. Now he works for the FTC in the top-level position. So the FTC became really a protector of these schemes. And why? Well, because they were in with the now presiding administration. I think it cuts across. I mean, let's face it, U.S. and Canada are integrated economies. Mm-hmm. And these powerful influences don't stop at border lines, at national borders. And I think Canada suffers from the very same thing that we have here. Political influence is buying the protection of these schemes. The laws are really not being enforced. Investigations are not happening. That's the long and the short of it. It's not a nice picture, but I think it's a real picture.
We have a question from the chat. This is from PHI Guy.
My in-laws were involved in something called Shakely that I thought was a pyramid scheme. I tried to explain it to them, but they were convinced it was legit. What is the best vaccination against this?
We have a few questions that we put on our website. If you go to the pyramidschemealert.org website, and it's called What About This One? I wish I had a nickel for every person that has asked me, how do you get through to somebody who's bitten by this bug and who's become a believer? And how do you get them to look at the shape of this thing, the business model, and to do their due diligence? It's very difficult. And the first question we always ask people, look, if it's a good program, a good legitimate business, and it's a sales business, here's the first question. could you earn a sustainable profit from just selling the product without ever enrolling another person to also become a salesperson? Is it sellable? Is there enough profit margin in it to justify your time and your cost and your inventory expense and your travel and so on? If, in other words, is it really a direct selling business that people could earn money in? Could you do that? And not only could you think you do it, but are many people doing it? So all they have to do is ask, how many people are earning a sustainable profit from this business who aren't enrolling anybody else? They're not recruiting. They're selling. If the answer to is yes on those questions, then go for it. Legitimate. You can't find a more honorable profession than direct selling, door-to-door selling, the Yankee peddler. You know, that's the hardest. They're the soldier ants of an economy, right? I mean, I admire anybody that can do that. I've done it in my lifetime at some points, not for multi-level marketing, but I've done direct selling. I know how hard it is. I know it is an engine of our economy to sell something. But if it requires recruiting, then you have to produce two others, at least. The two have to do just what you did, because if it isn't feasible to sell, it won't be feasible for them either. So those two now need to make four. Well, and the four have to make eight. In other words, if it's not feasible for you, it's not feasible for anybody. So why in the world would you recruit somebody into such a business? Oh, you recruited them into a business in which the real opportunity is to recruit? Well, that won't work. That's going to place the vast majority in the bottom ranks where they can't make money, since retailing is not the basis of making money, and it can't keep growing forever either. So the last ones in are likely to lose, and they will be the majority. And if they lose, the scheme can simply replace them, so the scheme could keep going while it just churns through losers. So bottom line, you know, that's the one question. To me, that's the acid test. If it's direct selling, you ought to be able to make a living selling without recruiting. If you have to recruit, then everybody has to recruit. And if everybody has to recruit, you're in a scam.
Robert, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we'll be right back with Paul K. Piff, a researcher at the University of California, Berkeley, who's studying the relationship between social class and ethical behavior. That's next on Skeptically Speaking.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're talking about the perspective of science on the mechanisms of belief. We're joined by science writer Jesse Baring to discuss his book, The Belief Instinct: The Psychology of Souls, Destiny, and the Meaning of Life. And we'll dive into the neurology of religious faith with Dr. Andrew Newberg, author of How God Changes Your Brain. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Paul Piff, PhD candidate and research scientist in psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. Now, we're going to be talking about a number of studies that you conducted on wealth and ethics. And I came across your work because a few days ago, it seemed like every second person on my Facebook feed was actually posting the Wired article about it. So I guess, first off, what brought this research on?
That's a great question. So I have been in collaboration with colleagues of mine at Berkeley and in universities in Canada and on the East Coast, really been interested in the question of how does inequality and hierarchy in society, so different levels of wealth and educational attainment and occupational prestige, how do these different things sort of shape how people see the world, how they act toward one another, and really their sort of levels of compassion and pro-sociality and altruism and generosity toward just the people that they interact with on a daily basis. So we've conducted upward of sort of 20 to 30 studies that really try to map these behavioral differences that arise out of people's sort of social class based on their income, their money, their wealth, the jobs that they have, and again, their education, whether they, say, got a college degree or simply have a high school diploma. this most recent work is sort of guided by that very basic question. We found really interesting and significant differences that arise out of a person's social class, finding that a person's social class really uniquely and significantly shapes a person's very basic social tendencies toward other people. And so in this most recent work, we were really interested in sort of exploring that basic question of how does a person's wealth, their status in society, shape and even influence their tendencies to break the rules in their own favor.
So maybe tell us about the studies, because you've done a number of really interesting ones. Let's start with the monitoring traffic at a four-way intersection.
You know, we, as social psychologists, we try to think of ways to measure things in the lab, and in the process of trying to come up with direct and specific assessments of behavior, in certain ways we kind of isolate behavior from its real-world context. This is in a scientific attempt to look at directionality and causality of one variable on another. So in an effort to kind of complement the laboratory research that we'd done, we were interested in sort of exploring the influences of social class in an everyday way. So one of the ways that we came up with of sort of looking at this was by conducting some field experiments where we just observed whether drivers of more expensive vehicles, which was our sort of imperfect but best indicator of social class or socioeconomic status in this real-world context, looking at whether drivers of these more expensive vehicles were more or less inclined to break the law while driving. So in one study, we had coders sort of hidden out of drivers' view at a four-way intersection observe whether, first, someone who pulled up to this four-way intersection was driving a more expensive vehicle, like say a BMW or a Mercedes of a recent model, and then proceeded to cut off other vehicles by improperly entering the intersection before it was their turn. A second study, we posed a confederate of the experiment, so this is someone that we've hired to act as if they were a pedestrian, walking up to a crosswalk. Someone was hidden out of view, coding the expensiveness of a vehicle as it approached this pedestrian crosswalk, and then noting whether or not the driver of the car yielded for the pedestrian, which is, again, another kind of behavior that is against vehicle code in California. And so across those two studies, we were really amazed to see that the drivers of those most expensive vehicles, so drivers of, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 cars, were actually anywhere from 3 to 4 times more likely to break the law than were drivers of our lowest status vehicles.
So how about another experiment? What would they do when they're given change for a $20 bill?
You know, assessing the kind of car that a person drives is, you know, it's an imperfect indicator of your socioeconomic status. So in follow-up lab studies, we wanted to sort of more directly assess a person's social class to get really more directly at this effect of how much money and status a person has on their tendencies to behave unethically. So in this follow-up study, we just brought people into the lab, had them complete a variety of filler measures, which included assessments of their demographics. So they told us about their age, their ethnicity, as well as their socioeconomic background, by just thinking of their own levels of educational attainment, income, and occupational prestige, and rating that relative to other people in society on a ladder. So they just indicate where they stood relative to other people on a ladder that had 10 different rungs. And then we had them complete this measure of unethical decision-making, where they indicated how likely they would be to do a bunch of different unethical things, including, for instance, imagining that they were paying for a coffee and a muffin at a coffee shop. They paid with $10 but received change for $20. How likely would they be to keep that extra change despite it not really being justifiably theirs? Another hypothetical scenario asked participants to indicate whether or not they would be willing to cheat with fellow students on an exam if they obtained access to the exam's answers. And across these different scenarios, upper-class individuals, that is, our participants who indicated being from upper socioeconomic backgrounds, were significantly more likely to say that they do a whole slew of unethical things than were participants who came from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And that is controlling for a host of other variables, including, you know, their ethnicity, their age, their gender. So really, the effect of socioeconomic status or the influence of socioeconomic status on a person's unethical decision-making tendencies. And that study really held while even accounting for a whole host of other variables that could have otherwise influenced that relationship. You might be thinking, well, is it the case that, you know, unethical people simply become wealthy? Or is it really, as you argue, or as we argue in the paper, that being wealthy in fact gives rise to unethical tendencies? And you can imagine that both cases may be true, but it's in this follow-up study that we wanted to really directly look at whether the experience of higher class, that is the feeling that you belong to a higher class in society, actually causes people to behave more unethically. Now, we can't bring people into the lab and give them hundreds of thousands of dollars and make them, say, an upper-class individual and then look at how that changes their behavior. But what we can do, for instance, is bring people into the lab and have them simply compare themselves to people at the top or the bottom of the social hierarchy. So, for instance, we could ask them to compare themselves to someone all the way at the top who has the most amount of money, the most amount of education, the best job. And in the process, they might feel as if they're somewhat lower in social class because they've just compared themselves to someone who's way above them. Alternatively, we could ask someone to come into the lab and just temporarily compare themselves to people who are all the way at the bottom of the social hierarchy, someone who's unemployed or has never had a job or who has very little money and very little educational attainment. And by comparing yourself to someone at the bottom of the social hierarchy, you might feel somewhat higher in social class. And that's exactly what we did. We had people either compare themselves to people at the top or bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. Then they completed the same measure of unethical decision-making that we had them complete in the prior study. So how likely would you be to keep extra change or cheat on an exam? Then 15 minutes later, we tell them, okay, this is the end of the study. Please enter the hallway. At which point they met the experimenter. The experimenter said, look, I'm going to leave you alone for about a minute as I go set up the second part of the study. And while you're at it, there's this jar of candy. I've been asked to take this to give to children who are participating in a nearby lab, but you know what? Go ahead and help yourself if you would like. Amazingly, what we found is that participants, even if they came from actually lower class backgrounds, participants that we made feel higher in social class by comparing themselves to people who were below them in the socioeconomic ladder, not only did they increase how unethical they said they would be, so not only did they become more likely to keep extra change given to them at a coffee shop, they also took two times as much candy from children than did participants who compared themselves to people who were above them, so who felt somewhat lower in their social class. Now, what that suggests is that the experience of higher social class, so this experience of occupying higher ranks in society relative to other people, actually causes people in a very direct way to prioritize self-interest and potentially engage in even more unethical behavior. Now, in the next study, we wanted to sort of extend this more by not necessarily only focusing on the differences that arise between upper and lower class individuals in terms of their unethical tendencies, but also looking at that question of why. So if it is in fact the case that upper class individuals are more inclined to behave unethically, why is that the case? So in this study, we had participants imagine they were participating in a hypothetical negotiation where they're negotiating a salary with another person. We created a situation in which essentially you could lie to the other person to increase your own bonus, to increase the chances that you would get this significant bonus in your job. So by lying to the other person, you'd better your chances of earning this cash bonus from your employer. And we asked participants to indicate to us how likely they would be to lie to the other person. Now, participants who came from upper class backgrounds, like the other studies, were more likely to say they'd lie, and it was their tendencies to, in another measure, say that greed and the pursuit of self-interest was a moral and positive, socially beneficial thing that drove those increased tendencies to deceive another person. So it was their values toward greed, their more positive opinions about greed, that really seemed to explain their tendencies to behave more unethically. So in study six, rather than have people tell us what they would do, we directly assess what people do. And we do this by having people play a game. We tell them, today you get to play a game of chance where the computer is going to virtually roll a die for you five times. And in this game, higher scores, so higher rolls across the five rolls, are going to be equal to better chances of winning a game, of winning a cash prize. And because we can't keep track of your score, we're going to ask that you keep track of your score such that after the five rolls, you're going to report to us what your total was. That's what we told participants. Now, unbeknownst to them, the game's actually rigged. So each roll of the die is predetermined, such that across all five rolls, we know that every participant, no matter what, has rolled a total of 12. But by leaving it open to participants to report to us what their score was, we can really directly look at whether or not they were cheating. Upper-class individuals cheated by up to three times as much, and their tendencies to cheat in this game were again driven, explained, by their more positive and favorable attitudes toward greed.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Paul Piff, PhD candidate and research scientist in psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, about his recent research into ethics and wealth. So your interpretation of the studies is that wealthy people are assholes?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that. And, you know, we're not documenting that if you're wealthy, you're necessarily this way, and if you're not wealthy, you're necessarily this other way. You know, it's not the case at all that there are these categorical differences. And it's very, very difficult to predict behavior on an individual-by-individual basis. But what I would say is that if you look at broad patterns of behavior across hundreds of individuals, that you find a general tendency such that as a person's rank and levels of wealth in society increase, so too do their tendencies to break the rules and behave unethically to better their own welfare.
This does seem overly simplistic, doesn't it? Like it feeds into every negative stereotype about the wealthy?
It doesn't seem necessarily overly simplistic in the sense that it's documenting sort of a basic trend. And for every stereotype that we have of the wealthy and their bad behavior, you can imagine a competing stereotype about how poor people or those who come from dire or disadvantaged environments behave. There are lots of stereotypes about lower SES individuals and, say, violent crime and crime rates in neighborhoods that have concentrations of poverty. So I think it plays into maybe a certain intuition that people have about how levels of wealth may affect behavior. But, you know, there are really interesting counter-stereotypes that sort of run in contrast to those prevailing ideas. And I think this research helps sort of set the record straight in terms of what it is that seems to be the relationship between social class and unethical behavior.
Well, I don't know if you've been reading the comment section of the Wired article by chance, but there seems to be some polarization. So let's talk about some of the arguments. The first couple of studies that you mentioned, the unethical tasks are fairly trivial. So wouldn't that mean that there isn't the evidence to link to those really deep down unethical behaviors? Like you can't necessarily extrapolate to a Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme, right?
Right. It's not the case that everyone that we observed breaking the law would engage in a Ponzi scheme. Not at all. And at the same time, you know, the behaviors that we're observing in those first two studies are in explicit violation of the law. So it may not be the most nefarious of all acts, cutting off a pedestrian at a crosswalk, but certainly we would all agree that it's not necessarily indicative of an all-encompassing sensitivity to other people in your surroundings. And it seems to sort of cohere around this idea that maybe upper-class individuals endorse that maybe in a way they're above the law, or the law doesn't necessarily apply to them because they have more important things to do or more important places to be than simply stopped at a crosswalk waiting for someone to pass. So it's not the most pernicious of behaviors, but certainly it's indicative of the everyday kinds of behaviors that people can engage in, sort of privileging their own welfare above the welfare of other people. You know, we can't bring in dozens of people and have them engage in a Ponzi scheme to see whether or not they would be even willing to do that. So, you know, this is an attempt to sort of map out everyday kinds of unethical behavior, the kinds of things that people can engage in, even without necessarily even thinking about it. You know, people may not be aware of having cut off a pedestrian. These are things that people may be engaging in unconsciously. But it's our attempt to get at the kinds of everyday ethical behaviors or unethical behaviors that I think transpire regularly between people.
Well, and the sample sizes are quite small with all of these studies, correct? So could that overestimate the importance of the wealth differences?
You know, we have finite resources, so we try to, you know, we try to run a lot of different studies that look at a lot of different kinds of ethical and unethical behavior that control for a lot of different kinds of variables. Running the kinds of experimental procedures that we run often require, you know, participants to spend an hour of their time engaging in some methodology. We can't simply call people up on the phone and have them complete some questionnaire. We're doing more than that. So sample sizes may be small for some kinds of research, but I think in the kind of work that we do, having assessed 1,000-plus people and finding across all of these different studies a main effect of somewhere around 0.2, 0.3 is in the face of the other kinds of variables that could be shaping unethical tendencies that we're accounting for, that's a huge effect. You know, an effect of 0.2 or 0.3, for those of your listeners who are statistically inclined, while accounting for the range of other variables that are likely to exert an effect, that's really sizable. I mean, we're accounting for your political orientation, your religiosity, your gender, your sex, your ethnicity, and even above and beyond those other variables, your social class alone is significantly shaping your unethical tendencies. Now, would this also be the case if we had access to 100,000 participants? We don't know, but we have good reason to suspect that it would be. There's nationwide epidemiological surveys, for instance, that have been done. We didn't do these. These are ones done by other laboratories, other researchers, that look at, for instance, household income as it relates to people's tendencies to shoplift. And counterintuitively, it's the richest households in the United States that are anywhere from 3 to 4 times more likely reporting having shoplifted in their lives than the lowest income households. So our findings may be surprising. Other people may argue that we haven't done a good job of really assessing the relationship between class and unethicality, but really our findings are so robust they conform to all sorts of other research that's been done on related areas.
Well, and that brings me to the candy study, because specifically in that one, it could be that the subjects were just mimicking the behaviors that they would stereotypically attribute to wealthy people, right?
That may be the case. I mean, my question to whoever it is that raises that would be, if there is, in fact, a prevailing conception or a prevalent stereotype concerning upper-class people, say, taking more candy from others or taking more valued good from others, that could be the case. But, you know, afterwards we interview participants regarding what they think happened during the experiment, and no one reported any kind of suspicion that they'd been manipulated into feeling like they belonged to an upper or lower-class category. So I'm a little bit wary of thinking that we're necessarily making people just want to behave in ways that are consistent with the role that they've been put in. But certainly, that kind of priming explanation that you've just offered is totally consistent with the idea, and one that we throw out there, which is that, you know, we're priming people to think of themselves as higher or lower class. And in fact, that may, in fact, be what's causing them to behave in more unethical or less unethical ways. But really getting at what's specifically happening psychologically, that experiment doesn't do. All we know is that getting people to think of themselves as upper class is sufficient to cause them to behave more unethically. Why that's the case, we don't yet know, and we're going to need more studies that more directly look at that to really be able to ascertain why it is that that's the case.
Well, could there actually be another reason for the results? When I was reading this, I was thinking maybe competitiveness, because competitive people may be more likely to reach a higher socioeconomic status, and so they could also be more likely to be unethical about how they get there?
I love that. In fact, the way that we measure people's attitudes toward greed has items in it that really look at how competitive a person is. So I think competitiveness is a part of this. I don't think it's only about how positive you think greed is that's driving your tendencies to behave unethically. I think how competitive you are temperamentally, the cultural background that you come from, whether or not your parents, for instance, taught you that competition is a valuable thing that you ought to pursue versus egalitarianism and equality being something that you ought to value. I think your parenting is going to have a big issue, I think, or a big role here. I think the kind of job that you have, whether you're an executive at your job versus someone who works a lot with other people, I think that's going to have an effect. So I think that there's a slew of variables, a whole host of variables that are associated with just this basic tendency to privilege self over others and decreased sensitivity to others' well-being that I think is correlated with increased social class, and that's going to help drive those effects. We've had, you know, dozens of studies where we look at levels of generosity, levels of compassion, levels of empathy in physiology, in your behavior, in your eye contact with other people. Whether you check your cell phone versus establish eye contact with a stranger. Are you rude in your interactions versus really engaged? And across all of these different studies, we find the same basic pattern. The people who are wealthier, who come from upper ranks in society, are actually ruder in their interactions. They're less compassionate, less empathetic, more likely to privilege themselves over other people. And the reasons for that, I think, are complicated. I think that they arise from all sorts of very basic psychological factors that come from occupying privileged positions in society. On a very, very basic level, I think that levels of privilege, increased status in society, wealth, if you will, in many ways kind of serves as a psychological veil, a buffer that gets people to inhabit increasingly insulated social worlds where they don't have lots of contact or lots of exposure to the needs of other people. They don't need other people as much. They're less reliant on their social relationships. And I think it's because of all of these psychological and behavioral tendencies that are associated with just this privilege and entitlement and higher status that we find in our studies, they're more inclined to be unethical. That's also not to say that that's necessarily the case. There are lots of important counterexamples. Lots of wealthy people do lots of ethical things. It's not the case that if you're wealthy, you're necessarily unethical, or that those patterns can't be changed. But what our work is at least an initial attempt to do is to map out how levels of inequality in society and concentrations of wealth in the hands of a select group of individuals may shape very basic patterns of ethical and unethical conduct. So some of your listeners may be wondering, is it the case that you've proved or scientifically conclusively shown that it's necessarily the case that upper-class individuals are more unethical? To that, I'd say no. You know, it's very, very difficult to scientifically prove anything and scientifically prove an answer to any kind of question like this. But what I think our findings do show is our best attempt to very rigorously examine the question of how social class affects people's unethical tendencies. And yes, they have problems. And yes, there are all sorts of limitations that are going to inform the kinds of follow-up studies that we and others conduct to get at better assessments of unethical behavior and to arrive at a better understanding of what it is and how social class shapes people's unethical tendencies. But what I think is certainly the case is that if you look over the studies that we've conducted, and look at the assessments that we conducted on 1,000 or close to 1,100 different participants in the laboratory, online, and in the real world, that the findings we document are pretty compelling and at the very least suggestive that higher social class, very interestingly, does predict increased unethical behavior.
It is a fascinating series of studies, sir. And I assume I'm going to get many angry emails. So thanks for being here.
Well, please forward them along when you do.
We've linked to both Paul Piff's study and the Wired article about it on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, do click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, so that you can receive program updates, and also click on iTunes, where you can listen to archived episodes and subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.